Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan. I appreciate you being here. I just finished up a conversation with Mitchell Askew, lead analyst at Blockware Solutions. Mitchell is an awesome guy, also the recent author of The Conservative Case for Bitcoin, which I have just started reading. It just got delivered to my house late last night, so I'm a few chapters in, but he's a great writer. It's a great book. I think it's very important and good to bring balance to many of the progressive case for Bitcoin type books that are out there as well, and to get another perspective. But Mitch is an incredible optimist about the future of the United States, as well as Bitcoin, and was fun to share a conversation with a guy who also appreciates Thomas Sowell as much as I do. Anyway, I enjoyed this discussion, learned a lot. I hope you will as well. Alrighty, everyone. Like I said in the introduction, I've got Mitchell here. Mitchell, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Michael. I'm excited to chat.
Yeah, you bet. Well, hey, you just wrote a book. We've got a lot to talk about. I want to hear about your role sort of in the mining space as well. But let's just start with your background. Tell me a bit about your upbringing, your introduction to, you know, a more conservative worldview and traditional American values. And I think that'll help lend itself to this discussion about what you've written.
Yes, sir. So I grew up in North Carolina. I've lived here my whole life. My whole family's from the South. Very conservative people all around me growing up. So it was definitely sort of, I wouldn't say pushed on me as a child, but you know, when you're surrounded by people, you think similar to people. And as I got older, got into high school, Trump ran for office when I was a sophomore in high school, or sophomore or junior year. And things really started to get politicized at around that time, around 2015, 2016. And as an adolescent male, I took interest in that. I started reading guys like Thomas Sowell and listening to some of the popular conservative commentators at the time. And really, that was when I started to develop, I guess, critical thinking, like really thinking about more complex issues in society. And it always kind of captivated me. I've always been a fan of, you know, limited government influence in people's lives. And there's been a development, though, over the last few years, right? Especially as I found Bitcoin, I realized that politics itself is very much a rigged game. You can't necessarily get your values through the world through politics, especially when it comes to limited government. And also, Bitcoin opened my eyes in a way that, you know, I used to think, oh, the Republicans are the side for limited government and the Democrats are, they're the big government. But no, it's one giant party. They both spend money. One of the most fascinating charts I've encountered, and I actually put it in my book, is the U.S. national debt by president and by who controls Congress. And it doesn't matter which party is in office and which party controls the House or the Senate, like the debt just continues to mount year after year. I mean, President Trump signed the largest spending bill of all time in 2020, the CARES Act. It was something like $2 trillion. So both parties are printing money, and that's very un-American, right? The founding fathers established America on this idea of property rights. And when they print money without our consent, right? Nobody at the Federal Reserve is representing the interests of the American people. That's devaluing our hard-earned property if you save in dollars. And so that's really the thesis I kind of lay out in my book. And it's honestly, this is just like a culmination of a lot of things I've thought about over the past few years. And I'm only 23. It was always sort of a goal of mine to write a book. And I figured, why wait to later in life? I've got a lot I want to get off my mind right now. So it was about a year's worth of work. I started in April 2023 and I published it here in April 2024.
Good for you, man. Congratulations. So I'm curious, this is sort of divergent from what the direction I plan on taking us, but so I think Bitcoin did for me what it did for you. It opened my eyes to sort of this uniparty system. I'm much like you. I mean, my parents didn't talk politics or anything, but I grew up in a very conservative home, very traditional values, you know, Judeo-Christian ethics. And for the longest time, I was very interested in politics and I would have considered myself just like a Republican, right? Like a conservative Republican. And then Bitcoin opened my eyes to this, you know, this whole other world. This is like a dicey topic for a lot of people. And you actually mentioned, I've got your book right here. It just came late last night. So I'm just diving into it as of this morning. But does that change the way you think about voting? Like, do you vote and does it affect who you vote for or what?
Yeah. Well, this is definitely a dicey topic. And I'll just say straight up, I do not think the 2020 election was very legitimate. that's part of what pushed me down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. So if you flash back to 2020, what happened, right? COVID, massive lockdowns, high like government influence in your lives. Like, hey, Mitchell, you have to leave college. Like, you can't stay here. You know, there's riots, and then there's censorship online. There's money printing. There's a suspect election. Then all of that at the end of the year, with all that in mind, Bitcoin starts to rip. And so I see this asset moving at a very fast pace, and my trust in systems is already low. I know that the massive money printing is going to cause inflation. So that cocktail of cultural events and the Bitcoin bull market, that's what orange-pilled me. So I got into Bitcoin in late 2020. And on your question about voting, I'm definitely like swaying away from it, but I'm starting to come back, right? So if you would ask me, you know, a year or two ago, I would have been adamantly, no, there's no point in voting. It's all rigged. It's all facade. Doesn't matter who you vote for. And I still believe that to some degree on the federal level, but the local and state level, I think it's very important to vote. So there, the way I view politics is like the mayor of my town, right? He's not going to outright screw the people of my town because he actually has to live amongst us, right? But the people in Washington, D.C., they're so far removed from the constituents they represent. They have no desire or really no incentive to vote or pass policy in a way that's conducive to the interests of the people that voted them in, right? They're just there for their political career. That's their incentive to get reelected and to climb the ranks of the swamp, so to speak. So I don't necessarily view voting for federal offices as nearly as important as voting for state offices or, you know, your mayor, county commissioner, et cetera.
Yeah, no, I think I generally agree with that. The one thing that's always been tricky for me is while I have through Bitcoin begun to understand just how screwed up our geopolitical interests are abroad, and like there are still people who have shed blood for my right to have the liberty and the freedom that I have in the United States. And do I think that that was fought for in Vietnam? No, but like the Revolutionary War, I mean, you know, those sorts of things, like there are still people right. who have sacrificed immensely for me to have some level of say. And if you look at like Donald Trump, for all of his flaws that I think many people see, and who I voted for more as a vote against Hillary Clinton, it's like, look at the Supreme Court. We could have done a lot worse than what he did for the Supreme Court in terms of limiting size and scope of government, I think. And so, and I think border policy and like certain things, you can still have an impact at the federal level. And so while I feel like my vote is, you know, sort of washed away in this, you know, ocean of votes and probably illegal votes. And to your point about the, you know, the questionable nature of the 2020 election, I still find some utility and just like as a nod of respect for the people who have sacrificed, who have truly sacrificed for my freedom, if that makes sense. Does that make, yeah. I agree with you about the state and local level, way more important to your daily life.
Yeah, I totally understand where you're coming from with that. And I will say, and this is kind of like the thesis of my book, is that more important than your vote at the ballot box is how you vote with your capital. So money is your way to reflect your values onto the world. If I personally, I like grass-fed beef. And so when I go and buy steak, I'm inflecting that onto the world. I'm saying, hey, I like this thing, make more of it. And free market entrepreneurs are going to capture profits where they're captured, right? A lot of people in America will complain about, oh, you know, there's all this toxicity in the food and seed oils and stuff like that. Or, you know, people are way too much into football and sports and they should be focused on more important things. But people are just voting with their dollars, right? When someone goes and buys Oreos, the people that make the Oreos are going to make more Oreos, right? When people spend thousands of dollars to go to an NFL game, that's signaling to the market, we like this thing. Let's do more of that, right? And you can apply that same principle to how you save money. So I save in Bitcoin. I'm voting with my dollars by taking them out of the fiat system. If you buy, you know, the S&P 500 index, you're buying these FANG stocks in there, right? All the companies in the index, you're giving them your capital. You're effectively voting for them. You're like, hey, I like what you're doing. Here's some of my money. Same idea if you're buying government bonds. You're financing these things that we may or may not agree with that the federal government is spending money on, right? You're literally lending them money. And so I choose to vote with my dollars by saving in Bitcoin. That's where I'm putting my capital. I'm getting it out of the fiat system and I'm voting for Bitcoin.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, is your contention, because I haven't gotten through the whole book, obviously, I've only had a couple hours, is your contention that Bitcoin is, this vote for Bitcoin will sort of force the hand of political leaders to do what's right. Like you take away the money printer and we get enough adoption, this minority but growing number of people will allow Bitcoin to sort of overtake the powers that be in terms of influence.
It will force austerity on the federal government. So right now they run $1 trillion deficits every year. So that's them spending money they don't actually have, because they can issue all these bonds. But the only reason they can issue all these bonds is because they're backed by the Federal Reserve printing money, right? It's the risk-free rate. It's only risk-free because they can print money to pay back the debt. So if you get rid of their ability to print money, they can only spend what they can actually generate through taxation. And that's really going to handcuff them in a lot of ways. One, it just like they can spend less, period. And two, when you're having to levy taxes onto people, you really have to get them riled up for your cause, right? If you can just print the money, it doesn't matter if we want to go to war in Ukraine or the Middle East, right? They can just print the money to do so. But if they're going to actually have to directly tax us to finance those things, then they're going to have to really ramp up their propaganda to get people on their side and actually be willing to pay those taxes. So if I know Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, it still has a long way to go to scale technically, right? It works now for the number of people using it, but if 8 billion people tried to use it tomorrow, it wouldn't necessarily work. But let's imagine, you know, we do shift to a global Bitcoin standard where we could use this as money and entirely opt out, then the federal government is completely handcuffed and it's going to be more aligned with the vision I see for the world and the vision I think a lot of conservatives see for the world.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So could you start by with the book? I mean, start by defining how you view conservatism. What are the traditional American values that you think are worth protecting, and where have we gone astray?
Yeah. So one would be the nuclear family. Two would be limited government spending. Those are really kind of the key ones right there. And I see a lot of people talk about the decline of the nuclear family over the last, you know, six decades. If you look at the data, right, there's more divorces, there's more children out of wedlock. And a lot of this gets blamed on like feminism and stuff. And sure, there's a cultural element to this, but I think it's more of a financial problem, right? My grandfather in early 1960s, he bought his house for $8,000. He was the only one working. My grandma raised four children. Like, it was one income, right? You could not reasonably do that today in 2024 unless you're making a ton of money, right? On a relative basis. Like, he just worked like a regular job. Like, he wasn't an entrepreneur. He wasn't making, you know, the modern equivalent of like $500,000 a year. But because fiat has just eroded our purchasing power over time, it's a lot harder to sustain a family on one income. And there's a statistic I cite in the book. I think it's like a third of all childless people over 30. The reason they cite, or one third of people cite finances as the reason why they don't have children, right? So, And we're seeing sort of the state just replace the family. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that money is just being printed endlessly. So like this sort of destruction of the nuclear family unit caused by fiat money, I think that's one of the number one things Bitcoin could fix. And that's really where I see a lot of the alignment between Bitcoin and conservatism. The second would be property rights and limited government spending. And I kind of alluded to that already, right? We handcuff the government's ability to finance without taxation, right? Then that's a lot more aligned with conservatism. You can't claim to be, I want limited government, right? And then simultaneously be okay with them having a money printer, because those are just two incompatible worldviews right there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned you're young. I mean, this is really cool that you've gotten a book published already. What inspired you to write the book? I mean, do you have kids or a wife, or is this like an anticipation of things to come? And could you just maybe share a bit about that?
Yeah. So I don't have kids or a wife yet. Definitely. That's on my to-do list for sure. I'm only 23, but really it was more of like, I saw a niche that needed to be filled. So this time last year, actually, a guy named Jason, I think Mayer's his last name, he published a progressive case for Bitcoin. And I was already like in the early stages of this book, but when I saw that get published, that's really when I put my foot on the gas, right? Because I saw an opportunity. You know, Bitcoin is apolitical, right? But you can view it through all sorts of different worldviews, and you can view it through a liberal lens, and you can view it through a libertarian lens. You can view it through like the lens of someone who lives in the third world. And I wanted to frame it in a way for my people, right? For the people I'm surrounded by, conservatives. And as a side effect, like this book could be used to influence policymakers. really, I saw a vacuum for two areas in which I've spent a lot of time thinking about, conservatism and then Bitcoin. And I wanted to really, I guess, overlap and create a Venn diagram there and reach both sides of really my intellectual journey, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I think it's funny because I still have such a profound respect for our founding documents. Let's just talk about the United States specifically. And I'm actually going to be passing through DC here in a couple of months on my way out to Prague for BTC Prague. And I want to take advantage of that opportunity, not because I think that that DC is not a swamp, but there are so many things that were created with the best of intentions. And I mean, really, really good, that are easy to sort of dump on as Bitcoiners because it hasn't panned out in the way that we want it to. But I think there are a lot of truths to the original founding documents and philosophies to the United States that, if we were able to recapture those, maybe it's not the anarcho-capitalist paradise that some Bitcoiners want, but it's something much more resembling personal freedom, private right to private property, all of that. Is your opinion about that's my take. Is your opinion about sort of the founding principles of America changed? And is your hope to transition back to something that looks more like the America as it was designed, or do you view this as an opportunity to sort of remake America in another light? If that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I would say it's a mix of both. So the ideals set forth at the founding of America and the Constitution, I'm wholeheartedly aligned with those, right? You know, I can't remember which founding father said it, but the Constitution was made for a moral and religious people, right? We're seeking life, liberty, and property. I think those are great values to aspire to, but the Constitution as a piece of paper and just this kind of arbitrary rule set can't enforce that. So I actually wrote a whole chapter summarizing Jason Lowry's thesis on power projection and this idea of abstract power systems versus physical power systems. And sort of the TLDR on that is, you can have abstract systems like laws and courts and all of that, but what really enforces things at the end of the day is physical power, right? So in nature, when the lion goes to eat the gazelle, that's not illegal. There's no law against that, right? You can't stop it. It's just, it's physical force that defends the property, which in this scenario is the gazelle. Or when the colonials came to the Americas and took the land from the natives, right? There's no like law stopping that. The natives couldn't pass a law and be like, oh, it's illegal, you can't do this, because the colonials had power, right? So physical power defends property. And Bitcoin does that in cyberspace. So through the proof of work mining and the massive amount of energy necessary, Bitcoin actually enforces your property rights using physical power, which is like the base way to defend property across all of human civilization, across all of nature, across all of time. And the Constitution, while it's like, hey, you know, the government can't infringe on these things, it is just like written on a piece of paper, right? That doesn't physically stop them from doing that thing. Mm-hmm. But Bitcoin does. Bitcoin physically stops people from debasing your property. And it also physically protects speech in cyberspace. You're seeing it now with the inscriptions and ordinals and all that stuff. I'm very neutral on that. I don't care. But it goes to show, like, this is censorship resistant. This is like a free speech network. People don't like the ordinals and inscriptions and stuff, but the transactions are aligned with the Bitcoin consensus. They're completely valid transactions. People can't stop it. So it's a free speech network. So in that way, it's also very aligned with the founding principles, right? The very First Amendment is freedom of speech. And so Bitcoin offers that in a way that's not abstract. Like, it's literally defended by physical power.
Mm-hmm. I know Jason Lowry took a lot of heat for his thesis. He was on a lot of podcasts, obviously wrote a very lengthy did you read the entirety of his thesis?
I read a good amount of it, and then I listened to a lot of podcasts, so I got the core ideas down.
Yeah. I understand the opposition to his opinions, but I always thought, at least listening to him talk, it made a lot of sense. It never really struck me as like highly controversial in the way that I know it was for many people. So it's an interesting concept that you bring up. Another thing you talk about in your book, at least in the first few chapters, is the sort of insidious nature of central planning. Generally, obviously, as a conservative, the notion of free market capitalism is at the forefront of your mind. But specifically with respect to central banks determining the supply and price of money, if my belief is that if any other industry had that level of government intervention, and there are a lot of industries that have way too much government intervention, but that level of sort of microscopic intervention, there'd be riots, because you just would be, we're a freedom oriented people, even if we're giving up a lot of our freedom in many ways, but we're still freedom oriented, I would say. What do you think it is about monetary policy that allows government to monopolize this task in the economy versus other industries?
It is interesting. I definitely agree with you. If this were happening in any other industry, there would be riots. It would be very obvious. But for some reason, we've allowed money and the price of money to be centrally planned. And some of that, I think, boils down to a lack of education and understanding of what money is. So anybody alive in 2024, we've had the Federal Reserve since 1913. So we've all lived under paper money and fiat money. And you can say, oh, we were on the gold standard until 1971. I think that's bogus. That was just when it became like officially recognized, right? They had already done the fractional reserve banking. They already created more paper claims to the gold. That's just when they had to default on that, right? So we've all lived under fiat money. And if you ask anybody who's never studied Bitcoin or studied the question, what is money? They think it's just green pieces of paper. They don't necessarily understand why we use this. That's just their concept of money. And so they think that money stems from government. They think, they don't believe that it, you know, rises naturally in a free market. They think it has to come from government and it can't work any other way. Therefore, oh, you need people in Washington, D.C. to set monetary policy, just because that's how it's always been in people's lifetime. So I guess really the question would be, how did they get that by people in the beginning, right? How did they go from, you know, we've got gold to like, hey, you should use these paper claims? And I guess I would outsource that question to The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffith. There was clearly a malicious intent with the creation of the Federal Reserve. A bunch of bankers got together secretly and maliciously conspired to maintain their wealth and power. And they knew a central bank would be the way to do that. If you look at Karl Marx's tenets on Marxism and, you know, how to control the people according to his ideology, I think rule number 6 or 7 is you need a central bank, right? You need to control the supply and own the money printer to have total power, right? Because money kind of is power. So it's crazy that we allow central planning to go on in the most important industry, because every industry touches money, right? We use money across literally every aspect of the economy. Every industry borrows money. So these manipulations and these distortions that are caused by centrally planning money, it bleeds into every area of the economy. So there's nowhere to hide. Like, nothing is safe from the effects of this central planning.
Yeah, it's wild to think that there are just a handful of people alive who really remember now today there aren't really people alive who would remember a life before a government monopolized money printer. But it was just a generation ago that those people were still alive and could tell the stories about, you know, acquiring gold and storing it under their mattress or whatever. So do you think that Bitcoin then is this evolution of a return to effectively that? And I assume the answer is yes, or directionally yes. But then how do you think that plays out over what time horizon? Like, what are your sort of projections about the way this works?
Yeah. So to answer your question simply, one, yes, Bitcoin is sort of the evolution. And, you know, fiat money kind of did have to happen though, right? Because we, as a species, as humans, our ability to communicate and do trade increased so fast. Gold could physically not keep up. So you needed like digital ledgers basically to do that. And now we've got Bitcoin, which is a revert back to hard money, but it's digital, right? So we can actually keep up with the speed of commerce with our base layer money. And I think the timeline is all dependent on the fiat side of the equation, right? I think they're going to try to kick the fiat can down the road as long as they can, but we may be reaching that sort of tipping point, right? If you look at the macro landscape right now, the Fed's very much in between a rock and a hard place, right? If they keep interest rates high, then the interest payment on the debt is going to be inflationary because it's another trillion and a half on top of the existing deficit, right? And if they lower interest rates, well, that's going to be result in quantitative easing. And so the debt's going to grow that way, right? So they're definitely sort of at a point of no return. It's just a matter of how long can they sort of stand on this balance beam before inevitably, like, they're going to have to print, because it's either print or do a hard default, basically rugging boomers on their social security payments and pension funds. And like anybody who's holding treasuries, they're going to get rugged. So they're not going to do that, right? They're just going to print the money to pay that. That's the most politically palatable option. Mm-hmm. No one's going to run on the platform of, hey, let's not pay back these treasury bonds, right? They're going to just print the money to pay it back. So it's a matter of time. How long? I mean, it could be anywhere as soon as 5 years, but it could be another 20 years. And either way, in either scenario, Bitcoin continues to rise. And hopefully the sort of demise of fiat takes a longer time, right? If it happened tomorrow, it would be chaos, blood in the streets. Like it would be bad, right? It would be like Weimar Germany bad. And nobody wants that. Even if you're holding Bitcoin, your life will not improve because of that scenario, right? You're not, goods and services aren't going to be being produced, right? So your purchasing power going up in that scenario, there's nothing to buy because it's just absolute chaos. So hopefully that bleed takes many decades, and that's ideally, but you know, we never know, right? And you should prepare for the worst case scenario, but also remain optimistic and don't be black-pilled and don't be a doomer, because that's bad energy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm optimistic long-term. The way I see it is that they can kick the can down the road pretty far. It seems like they've done it for a long time anyway. And what seems most likely to me is that, yes, they're not going to default on their debt and rug boomers, basically, in particular, but really anyone holding bonds. What I think is more likely is QE, money printing, UBI, any number of, but the net effect of that, of course, is going to be inflation, potentially pretty rather severe inflation. And at some point, I don't know what the percentages are of people who own, you know, a portfolio of assets versus not, but let's say it's 50% of the country doesn't own assets. And so they have nothing to inflate or appreciate in value with inflation. Life is simply going to become unaffordable for those people. And I think we're already seeing cracks there. And so my sort of thesis on this is the first thing that we see is social unrest. Like that's where we really begin to see things get ugly. And I don't know how you respond, because then the other option is to go back to rugging, you know, the largest generation of, you know, out of their pensions and whatever, you know, treasury bond investments they have. Is that something you would expect in the short term? Does that base case seem reasonable, make sense? Or are you more optimistic even in the short term that we don't have to go through something rocky like that?
I think you're right. It's going to be turbulent. And we kind of have already seen that, right? In 2020, there was a bunch of civil unrest. There were riots in the streets. I don't necessarily think that's not going to happen, right? If prices continue to rise as they have, and things become more and more unaffordable for the everyday person, you're going to see that manifest in different ways. And it may not be so explicit as riots in the streets, but an uptick in crime, you know, an uptick in divorces, an uptick in kids dropping out of school, right? And just like youth delinquency. I think you'll see a deterioration, but it may not, like, it may be something where we look back and like, wow, this was a bad time. You might not see it like manifest in data in real time.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. So I got to ask, I want to talk about your role, what your company does, and hear a bit about that. But I have to ask, you mentioned Thomas Sowell near the beginning. I've got his Basic Economics up here. He's my favorite. That's my favorite single book. It changed my life. Would love to know if you have a favorite book of his, and if there are just any other influential conservative thinkers, writers that maybe have shaped your opinions.
Yeah, Thomas Sowell, definitely the GOAT. Basic Economics is my favorite book of his. I read that about 5 or 6 months before I became a Bitcoiner. And I think that kind of teed things up for me, because in that book, he goes a lot into how central planning is bad and it's going to destroy the economy. So that really helped me understand, you know, why we need less government influence in the economy. And I really enjoyed that. I would definitely rank him as number one. This guy's not conservative, but Saifedean, of course, he's sort of the Bitcoin native GOAT. Those two right there have really shaped my understanding of economics way more than, like, I got an economics degree in college, nothing. That was waste. But studying Thomas Sowell and Saifedean, that's really helped me understand what's actually going on.
Yeah, I think for me, I had a huge miss. So in high school, my senior year, I went to a small school, and they finally offered like an economics class my senior year, and our our teacher was like something of a libertarian kind of guy, and he chose basic economics by Thomas Sowell, and it ended up being the best and the worst class I ever took. We basically, it was like 12 or 13 guys only in the class, and our teacher was a baseball and basketball coach, and we basically sat around watching YouTube videos all day, and so it was like a lot of fun, but we learned nothing about economics. And it wasn't until years later, I don't know what it was, but I still had the book because I bought it and I just decided to read it, and it just changed everything. Like everything that I think you grew up learning sort of by osmosis and just sort of understanding, that's sort of how it was for me too. And this was the first time I'd ever read something that put into words why so many of these traditional values make sense. And I think that's right. A really impactful thing when you can suddenly begin to articulate and not just use intuition to come to your belief system.
Right. 100%. And a lot of what Thomas Sowell talks about, it boils down to personal responsibility, which gets a bad rap from people on the left. It's very much like a cliche characterism of conservatism, but you should take ownership of your own life, right? You should build a family and rely on your family rather than relying on the state. And to me, that's like Thomas Sowell's main thesis. And he cites a lot of data about, you know, the deterioration of the family unit, and he focuses a lot on the Black family, right? So in the kind of like post-slavery times, and even throughout Jim Crow, they had a tighter family unit, right? There was more like fathers in the Black household versus now, and he cites that as one of the main reasons they've sort of like, I guess, become lower on the economic rung over time is the demise of the nuclear family. And I think that's likely spot on, because I've been blessed, right? I grew up with a dad in the house, and not everyone is as lucky, right? I think that's like the ultimate privilege, is to have two parents that love you and raise you, right? So, I mean, Bitcoin can kind of bring that back, right? It allows people to actually save and plan for the future. It incentivizes responsibility across all sorts of domains. I mean, these types of people we were talking about earlier, the 50% that don't have assets, they're thinking about their next paycheck. They're thinking about, you know, how can I buy groceries this month? They're not thinking about long-term, build a family, build generational wealth, because they can't. They're just stuck in this fiat rat race. And I think Bitcoin fixes that.
Yeah. I think Bitcoin fixes so much of the personal responsibility. Like, there are so many people are going to either have to learn to sink or swim if there's no one to come to the rescue. And if your only option is buying or working for Bitcoin, and there's no one who can just hand you more of it, early on, I think it's really rocky, right? Because there are a lot of people who've just never had to, you know, government jobs, you name it, who they haven't had to really do anything or produce anything of real value to society. And now suddenly they're thrown into this. And we have this transition where it is no longer, there are no, the incentives that allow single parenthood and the incentives that allow irresponsibility, they're no longer there. Like that's the challenge today, is that the incentives are there for poor behavior effectively,
right?
Or for suboptimal behavior, right?
Right. Even on the institutional level too. I mean, there's a huge moral hazard with the banks knowing they can be super risky with your deposits because they're going to get bailed out. If you look at Bitcoin native institutions like FTX, there's no bailout for them when they do fractional reserve banking with the Bitcoin that was deposited on their platform, right? But then you compare that with Silicon Valley Bank, they can lend out customer deposits and put it in treasury bonds that get nuked, but they'll get printed. There's a backstop there, right? So If you're an institution, you can be risky. There is no incentive for responsible behavior. I think Steve Carell's character in The Big Short is like, F responsibility, nobody's being responsible, right? That's so true when you look at these financial institutions, and Bitcoin really rewires that incentive, because if I put Bitcoin on a exchange and they lend it out, eventually they're going to get busted, right? And there's no way to print and make people whole.
Yeah, exactly. So let's shift topic. Oh, well, just real quick. So everyone, hey, buy the book, Conservative Case for Bitcoin. It's you're a great writer, man. By the way, I'm only two chapters in or something. And obviously a lot of great points that you're making here and in the book, but just really fantastic writing.
I really appreciate that.
You bet. Hey, let's talk about Blockware. So tell me about the company and then a bit about what you do. And I want your opinions on a few things that you probably are closer to than I am.
Yes, sir. I'm excited to shift gears here and talk about this. So big week. I don't know when this podcast is going up, but it's April 15th. Halving is about 4 or 5 days away. And I'm really looking forward to that. And you would think, oh, well, you work for a Bitcoin mining company. Why would you be excited about the halving? Your revenue is going to get cut in half overnight. And it's because like the most efficient miners on the network, they embrace the halving, right? This is something you have to prepare for like years, months in advance. You got to buy the new generation ASICs, right? That's the key. And you got to have low power cost. And if you look at sort of the landscape of Bitcoin mining, right? The most efficient miners are going to survive the halving. They're going to stay profitable. And the halving fundamentally is, I think it's a bullish catalyst for the price of Bitcoin. You know, there's debate on that, but I think it's really a demand catalyst. And Dylan LeClaire makes this point a lot. It's like Bitcoin sort of flexing its guns and showing to the world, we're serious about this immutable scarcity thing. And there's almost this reflexive feedback loop, right? Because people see Bitcoin's historical price performance post-halving. And so they're like, wow, well, every time this event happens, Bitcoin rips in the months that follows. Maybe I should get into the market. And so there's just like this feedback loop there. And I think there's going to be a significant demand surge after this halving, especially now that there's a vehicle in place for institutions, the ETF. And so I'm super bullish about price action over the next like 6 to 12 months. And I don't like to be too moon boyish, but I'm really pumped about this halving. In the short term, I don't think price is necessarily going to do anything crazy. I think we're going to continue to probably go sideways in this upper 60,000s range, but I'm super excited because this is also my first Bitcoin halving. So to just see it and witness it is super interesting. And, you know, we can get into more detail around how this is going to affect miners if you'd like.
Yeah. Well, hey, real quick, when did you get into Bitcoin? Cause I'm class of 2022. So this is my first halving, my first bull run. I was sort of forged in fire because I saw the collapse of everything. And that was like my exposure to Bitcoin initially, 2 years ago. What's your story there?
Yeah, I got in late 2020, like right as the new year turned into 2021. So I got 1 year of like bull market vibes and up only. And then it's been down for most of my tenure since I started working in Bitcoin. It was, I started working at Blockware in March, 2022. So it's basically been all down since I've been in the industry, except for, 2023, you know, it was up, and 2024 has been exhilarating so far. So it's, I'm looking forward to really getting the first taste of the bull market, you know?
I know hitting that all time high felt nice. And now we've just been kind of hanging out, but that's my understanding is that's sort of the way it goes. So what has Blockware been doing to prepare for the halving? You talked about like the more robust your operations and the better you prepare, the more likely you are to survive. And we'll see some probably not. What exactly is good preparation?
Right. So we provide mining as a service. So we do a little bit of self-mining, but we build out data centers and we partner with other data centers to allow other people to mine Bitcoin. And so we've been really pushing new generation ASICs onto our clients. And a big thesis of ours, we built what's called the Blockware Marketplace. So you can buy and sell rigs online on our website, basically. And something people really don't think about when they're getting into Bitcoin mining, they view the ASIC as a completely sunk cost, but these things maintain value over time. They have a resale value. And historically, that's been very limited. Like, so new generation ASICs would come out and all the old generation ASICs would be made obsolete overnight. But we're seeing that trend start to break. So the S19 XP came out last year. It didn't make the S19 completely obsolete. Yes, the XP is a better machine, but the S19 still has resale value. Same now with the S21s from Bitmain that came out this year. They're better than the XP, but the XP is still a good machine. It still has resale value, right? And so each new generation machine, that resale value lifespan is growing. And so what that is doing is creating the secondary market for ASICs. And so our marketplace allows people to buy and sell and trade ASICs effectively. And ASICs are really correlated with the price of Bitcoin. So if you look at the price of S19s in early 2020, I think they were going for about like $2,000 a piece. And by the end, bull market top late 2021, they were trading for over $10,000 a piece, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this tight correlation. And that's something we've really been seeking to sort of capitalize on, is this volatility in the ASIC market, right? And so you could buy this machine, it's making Bitcoin for you at a profit the whole time, and the machine can go up with the price of Bitcoin. So there's a lot of room to sort of trade these machines, and you could denominate things in Bitcoin too, right? As Bitcoiners, we're always pricing things in Bitcoin. You know, any investment is the opportunity cost of just buying Bitcoin, and mining really is one of the only ways to actually outperform Bitcoin. You've got, you know, if you're venture capital and you get invest in an early stage startup that grows its revenue by 1,000x in a month, that'll outperform Bitcoin, but that's not available to everyone, right? So your alternative is Bitcoin denominated assets. So something like MicroStrategy, mining stocks, or buying ASICs and self-mining, those are really your only ways to truly outperform Bitcoin. And I think self-mining is the way to do that because you're constantly actually getting Bitcoin and taking it to cold storage, right? If you're trading MSTR or BTC pair and you want to make more Bitcoin, you have to like actually sell and cash out and take fiat and then go buy the Bitcoin. But when you're mining Bitcoin, you're always effectively like taking profits. If for you, taking profits is Bitcoin in cold storage, which that's what it is for me. So like buying ASICs and mining with them allows you to potentially outperform Bitcoin depending on when you buy in the cycle. And meanwhile, you're always getting Bitcoin into cold storage.
This episode of the Bitcoin Way podcast is sponsored by us, your friends at the Bitcoin Way. If you rely on a third-party or closed-source hardware wallet for your Bitcoin custody, you are compromising on how you store your wealth. The Bitcoin Way offers white-glove service to help you take full self-custody of your Bitcoin and sleep in peace knowing you've done it right. Like most Bitcoiners, we believe that your Bitcoin stack will one day be worth a lot more than it is today. Go to thebitcoinway.com to sign up for a free consultation with a member of our team. Don't delay on protecting your wealth and reach out today.
Yeah. What do you think it's been, what's caused these older model ASICs to retain value in a better fashion than over the last, 10 years?
Yeah, we're kind of hitting the thermodynamic limit in terms of ASIC chips, right? So these computer chips can only get but so small and still produce hashes per unit of energy, right? So the measure of a good ASIC isn't, necessarily hashes per second, it's watts per terahash. So how much energy is this consuming to produce hashes? And the S19J Pro, I think it was around 34 watts per terahash. The XP is around, I think, 21 watts per terahash. The S21 is 17.5 watts per terahash. But if you look at like the S19 to the S9 was like 98 watts per terahash. So there's a huge gap there in energy efficiency, but that gap between each machine is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So, a new machine coming out isn't so much better than your existing machine that it makes it obsolete. And so that's why we're seeing these longer resale values.
Okay. Are there any geopolitical implications, like with Taiwan or some of these other potential risks to like the semiconductor space? To what extent does that potentially impact Bitcoin mining, Bitcoin miners? And are there any supply chain squeezes that are still in place that would also bring value to older ASICs simply because newer ASICs are maybe harder to come by or are selling at an even greater premium because of other economic challenges?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up. And you can look at 2021 as sort of a case study in that. There was a lot of supply chain issues, and that sort of supply squeeze on ASICs is kind of why the S19s were trading for over $10,000 a piece. And we could see that same thing geopolitically, but really where it may manifest is these public miners have ASIC call options, right? So basically they can say on demand, like, hey, Bitmain, we want 10,000 rigs. And Bitmain doesn't just have these sitting in a warehouse. They're going to have to dedicate all their production resources to satisfying these call options and these orders from these large public miners that they're contractually obligated to do. And so meanwhile, they're not producing rigs for the general retail market. So that can create an ASIC supply squeeze along with, if the price of Bitcoin continues to rip, that concoction right there will definitely mean secondary ASIC prices are going to go up pretty significantly.
Yeah. So could you mentioned ordinals before, and I think it's something that like I have my opinion based on what I know, but it's not something I've dug into deeply. I don't really like, I haven't dug into like how it works, why it's even possible, what led us here. But could you explain the ordinals debate, how that's playing out, and maybe elaborate a bit on your view? Because obviously as a miner, there's benefit from a fee transaction perspective, but then some people claim it's just spam, it was a bug. Could you just sort of frame that out for anyone who is less familiar, probably myself included?
Yeah, so I for the most part tried to stay pretty neutral. I'm not super radically in either camp. I think if you're inscribing pictures onto the chain, probably not the best use of Bitcoin. I wouldn't do that personally. But then what kind of startles me is this super hostile anti-ordinal approach. Like, these guys are attacking Bitcoin. This is spam. They're breaking it. Like, we need to change things now. I'm more petrified by that approach versus people doing things that are aligned with the consensus protocols, right? They're not breaking Bitcoin. They're just paying a higher fee to do what they want to do. And I think this is a problem that sort of works itself out over the long term. If we're right about Bitcoin and this becomes the global reserve asset of the world, do you really think people are going to be paying fees to put monkey pictures on the chain? They're not going to be doing that, right? They're going to have to be competing with large financial institutions for settlement on the base chain. So I think this is something that just sort of sorts itself out over time. I think it's a phenomenon of a low fee environment. And two, scaling solutions will be built that we haven't even thought of yet, right? Bitcoin, it's 2024. So Bitcoin is 15 years old. That's really not a lot of time in the grand scheme of things. It only in the last couple of years became a $1 trillion market cap asset, right? If Bitcoin becomes a $100 trillion market cap asset, all the smartest minds in the world are going to become Bitcoin devs, and they're going to be building solutions that we can't even think of, right? Maybe Lightning isn't the layer two that brings Bitcoin to the world. Maybe it's something else created by a coder that hasn't even been born yet, right? So I think we got to really kind of expand our time horizon. And what you don't want to do is change the base layer and break things, right? And Bitcoin works right now. You know, maybe you don't like the ordinals and inscriptions, then that's your prerogative. I'm not a huge fan either, but it doesn't break Bitcoin. Bitcoin still works, and making hasty changes to the protocol is how we ruin this. So I am definitely in the side of let's not do anything. Let's just sit and wait. And people smarter than I am can debate these questions and figure out, you know, how do we scale Bitcoin appropriately? And I think that's a beauty of Bitcoin is that you can't really change it easily. And that's definitely a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, no, I think I generally agree with everything you said. The one place maybe I'd play devil's advocate here is, does having ordinals bring a level of unseriousness to Bitcoin that makes us look more like other cryptocurrencies that are trying to do everything and be everything to everyone? And is institutional investment, billionaire, you know, potential investors, are they going to be scared away by sort of the, I don't know, just sort of juvenile appearance of what some of these things are? It's like, oh, I thought this was supposed to be sound money, not a place to store your stupid digital files or something. And does that impact adoption in any meaningful way long-term, or does it delay adoption enough that it does have a material impact? I asked that question, and that's the question I'm interested in you answering. That said, I completely agree with you that I don't know that making some radical change to the code makes sense. Like, I think we agree there.
Yeah, I don't think we've seen that so far. We've seen these ETFs get passed and institutions kind of approach Bitcoin with the seriousness that it demands. Mm-hmm. And two, I think a lot of them view Bitcoin, they view Bitcoin as BTC USD without any thought as to what's actually going on chain. If you ask some of these like ETF people and Bitcoin, you know, financial advisors or whatever, they're saying, hey, you should take a 1% Bitcoin allocation. If you ask them about, you know, Opcat and Opreturn, I think they would look at you like you're crazy. I don't think they have any idea that this kind of stuff is going on. Yeah. And I mean, if you imagine some of the people speculating in public markets on the mining stocks, and they look and see, oh, what's this surge in revenue from the transaction fee revenue? They might even have no idea, right? I don't think these kind of things are even being thought of outside of the Bitcoin community. Yeah. And two, when I first got into Bitcoin, I don't know about you, but a huge narrative was Bitcoin's the most secure decentralized blockchain. Any application that needs a blockchain will inevitably be built on Bitcoin. And like it or not, that's what's happening right now. And it's weird to see like how that was a narrative when I first got into Bitcoin. And now that's being rejected. Like, hey, we don't want any of that. And, you know, personally, I don't think there's really any use for blockchain outside of money, but other people do. There is a big market for like, quote unquote, DeFi. And, you know, I mean, what's Ethereum, right? It's like a $400 billion market cap thing. I think it's all bogus and just nothing. And it's like casinos, basically. But some people view it with a level of seriousness. And if they are serious about, you know, decentralization and blockchain technology, they are going to migrate to Bitcoin because that's the only truly decentralized blockchain. So I think we're just seeing that sort of play out.
Yeah, I think that's probably about as good of an answer as you could have given. I think the other benefit too, though, you mentioned like the number go up. They're just looking at USD to Bitcoin and what that looks like. And then the other thing I would add is the longer Bitcoin, each day that Bitcoin doesn't die and adds hash rate to the network and becomes increasingly secure, it becomes more and more appealing to these big investors who, to your point, also don't know that this ordinals debate is even probably happening. So I think that's a fair observation. Something I've heard a bit more about is I'm in terms of my knowledge of mining, I'm still a novice. I understand at the base layer functionally how it happens, but I don't really know practically how it plays out in the real world. I hear about the centralization risk of fewer and fewer pools. You've got like Ocean Mining now trying to sort of create a different way of going about this. I'm curious if you view any of those risks as material, and if Blockware does anything in particularly, you know, in particular that's unique, and just your overall opinion on that subject.
Yeah, I wouldn't say Blockware, we necessarily do anything unique. We kind of operate through FPPS pools the same way everyone else does. I won't say which pool we use, but I'm a fan of Oceans in theory, right? I don't necessarily agree with like the super anti-ordinal hostility, but what I do like about them is the transparency around transaction fees, right? So people miners hashing to the Oceans pool, they're getting their payout directly from the Coinbase transaction, directly from the Bitcoin network. It's not going to the pool and then going to the miner. The code is actually like directly from the newly minted Bitcoins goes straight to the hashers in that pool. I think that's fantastic. And I also think the ability to design your own block template is fantastic. And I think that's the future of really making sure pools stay decentralized is customized block templates. Like I am hashing to a pool, but this is the block that I want to mine, right? It's not some mystery block that I'm contributing hash to that may be censoring transactions. It's your own template. So I would definitely say I appreciate what Oceans is doing and sort of I think they're trailblazing in a way, like how Bitcoin mining pools should really operate. And, you know, maybe there's an Oceans pool that operates that way and they're anti-ordinal. And maybe there's another pool that's similar, you know, custom block templates, Coinbase transaction payout, but they're pro-ordinal, right? So you as a miner can dictate where you want to point your hash.
Mm-hmm. So there's no like existential threat in terms like centralization threat to Bitcoin mining in the current arrangement of pools, or could we get there where you maybe get uncomfortable with like the, you know, every hour it's the same three pools or two pools that are effectively mining every block? What are your thoughts on that?
It depends on what you would classify as centralization, right? So let's view this from a nation state perspective, right? Let's say I'm Russia and these US based pools are going to censor transactions of the Russian government. All you really need is enough hash to like regularly get a block, you know, maybe get a block once a day to process your transactions. So I think we'll see like nation state mining pools, right? Like a lot of it is centralized like in the US right now, but if we're right about Bitcoin mining being this global competition for low cost power, you're going to see all sorts of different entities tap into their resources to start mining Bitcoin. And, you know, Max Keiser's talked about hash wars, and Jason Lowry talks about this in his book. I think mining pools will decentralize in that way, where nation states and anybody with access to an abundance of power, they're just going to self mine. They're not going to pool, like they're going to have their own pool and they're not going to point to, you know, whomever to mine Bitcoin.
Got it. Okay, so let's round this out. So I would be curious to hear your general forecast over the next 12 to 18 months. What happens with, you talked a little bit, but post-halving, what happens with hash rate, to the extent you're willing to talk about price predictions, anything like that?
Yeah, I think transaction fees on-chain will be high. They always are during bull markets, and now you've got this ordinal stuff compounding on that. So if you didn't consolidate UTXOs, you might just have to sit on your hands for a while, honestly, which you should do anyways, HODL. But at the time of writing, I think transaction fees are up to almost 200 sats per V byte. And I don't know that they'll necessarily go back down in any time in the next couple months. fees are volatile, right? So we'll go through cycles. We'll get back to a time where fees are relatively low. And when that happens, you should jump on it, consolidate your UTXOs. If you don't know what that means, do research. Just search UTXO consolidation, find some videos, because this is a, if you've been doing the right thing, buying Bitcoin, dollar cost average, taking self-custody frequently, you're going to have a lot of UTXOs you want to consolidate. So one, I think fees are going to be high. Two, I think number is going to go up. The degree to which it does, I think a lot of that hinges on fiat liquidity. So does the Fed go to QE later this year? Doesn't seem like they're going to cut rates, but who knows? I mean, and even with rates being high, like I mentioned earlier, that's inflationary. And so a lot of it, the number go up, I think is going to happen. How much depends on the fiat side of the equation. And three, I think you're going to see more institutional embracement of Bitcoin, as we already have with these ETFs. Maybe we get another public company or another nation state to really adopt Bitcoin. I think there's some black swans. You know, we don't know what's going to come, but it's going to be bull market. It's going to be exciting, and definitely make sure you're holding your own keys.
Yeah, I love to hear that. Well, Mitchell, I can't thank you enough, man. This has been great, helpful. Why don't you tell everyone where to find you again? The book, tell them what it's called. Tell them where to get it. Tell them where to follow you and find you online.
Yeah, sir. I really appreciate you having me on, Michael. My book is called The Conservative Case for Bitcoin. You can see it right here. It's got Bitcoin, the American flag. You can find it on Amazon, searching The Conservative Case for Bitcoin. Price of $17.76. That was intentional. And if you want to keep up with me and what I'm doing, the Bitcoin mining research I'm putting out, just follow me at Mitchell Hoddle on Twitter. That's pretty much the only platform I'm on. So really appreciate you taking the time to do this, Michael.
You bet, man. Hey, thank you so much for the time. This was a wealth of information for me. Anytime I get the chance to talk to a Thomas Sowell fan, I'll take it.
Absolutely. All
right. Thanks, man. Cheers.
See ya.
And that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Mitchell obviously knows his stuff when it comes to Bitcoin mining, but I loved hearing his perspective on traditional values and some of what's lost when the incentives are broken. And I'm as optimistic as he is for the future of America, and hope that Bitcoin can bring about a bright orange future in the land of the free. Check out Mitch online. Check out what Blockware Solutions is doing. Follow them on Twitter. Follow him on Twitter. Lots of great content. And of course, if you need help with self-custody, if you are KYCing yourself to a third party and then entrusting them with one of your keys for a collaborative multi-sig, you can do better. We will, with White Glove Service, help you achieve peace of mind with your Bitcoin self-custody setup. And of course, follow me on X, Twitter, whatever we call it. It's at the other M Jordan. And you can check out my personal newsletter. It's Black Hat Bitcoin. So it's my Substack. And hope to see you next time. Until then, this is Michael Jordan signing off.